Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. Our guest physicist today is Jörg Schmaljön, who heads the Institute for Theory of Condensed Matter at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology. His research group is working on strongly correlated electron systems and complex quantum matter, and in more common terms, interested in understanding new materials with novel electric, optic, magnetic, or thermal properties. Before moving to Germany, he was a full professor at Iowa State University and senior scientist at the Department of Energy Ames Laboratory. David Uhlfelder from Aspen High School and Ishmael Villegas from Glenwood Springs High School will be interviewing Jörg. And we will begin with Ishmael.
Hello, my name is Ishmael. I'm a rising senior at Glenwood Springs High School, and I became interested in physics my sophomore year. My first question for today, for Jörg, is when did you become interested in becoming a physicist?
Well, I was always interested in math and sciences at school. I'm originally from East Germany, where mathematics Olympiads were very popular and I participated. But physics wasn't exactly what I had in mind when I was 16 or 17. And so I had a smart teacher who convinced me that this is something I should be doing. And he tricked me into studying physics, mostly by telling me there will be so many girls studying physics, so that's what I should be doing.
When you started learning about physics, what were some of your favorite concepts?
Well, when we study physics at high school or at school in general, usually I didn't understand. So the whys are the ones that I never really caught, at least in school physics. The beauty of what you learn when you actually study physics is that you get the beauty of the underlying structure of the theory that tells you how a theory is mathematically organized and gives you a beautiful answer. So what I love most are aspects that are related to conservation laws. Why is the planet always orbiting in a plane around the sun or the moon around the Earth? Why doesn't it some jiggly-wiggly kind of orbit? There's a fundamental and very simple principle behind it. Those so-called symmetry principles are the one I find most fascinating.
What field are you in right now that has come out of what you were interested in?
I personally am a theoretical physicist, and I work in condensed matter physics. What it means is you're studying solids or complex liquids and their behavior. Particularly what I'm interested in is superconductivity. So matter has many states, liquid and a gas and a solid, a magnet and a non-magnet. And probably the most fascinating one, the coolest one clearly, is superconductivity. So a material below a temperature that just doesn't have any electrical resistivity. So it has frictionless motion of electronic charge through a wire. And of course, we all have heard that this might help us saving electricity, but it also has many, many other fascinating applications. It causes large magnetic fields, which we know when we go or have to, unfortunately, go to take an MRI test, or when we want to build a quantum computer. The most promising building block for a quantum computer are superconductors. We try to understand those superconductors.
What specifically have you and your team done to advance that field?
Okay. Every physicist is by nature humble, so you never think that you would contribute so much to what is going on. Maybe not all of them are humble. Anyway, superconductivity was initially discovered in 1911, and it was understood, many people thought, in 1957 by three pioneers of our area at the University of Illinois. And Since then, however, we have learned that there are many, many materials that don't seem to be describable or naturally described by the conventional old theory of superconductivity, and we are trying to develop the new ones and have made, I think, some significant progress. What you really need to do is you need to take two electrons and glue them together. And once you manage this, the system will very naturally want to become a superconductor. It forms so-called pairs. The reason why you form those pairs of electrons, I believe during the last decade or so, or two decades, we've learned a lot that there are new mechanisms to do this, and we have contributed to identifying those.
And in what current ways are superconductors being used?
Okay, as I mentioned, because the currents flow without friction, and any current, as you know, induces a magnetic field. And these magnetic fields are being used in magnetic resonance imaging techniques, right? So when you go to a hospital, chances are you have a niobium titanate-based superconductor there that is responsible for the imaging of soft tissue. But there are others. In Karlsruhe, where I'm from, in Germany, there's a large group that had built just recently a 1 kilometer wire out of the most recently discovered high-TC superconductors that goes for 1 kilometer in the city of Essen and supplies 10,000 households with it. And it's now running for a couple of years. It's what we always dreamed of. And now we are slowly getting toward that. It's still subsidized, but it works. And the third one I should mention is, as I mentioned, when you want to build a quantum computer. So a computer that exploits the beautiful superposition of states of the up bit and the down bit, the one and the zeros, in using the games of quantum mechanics, those can be most naturally and easily realized with superconducting devices. So those are the applications.
So I've been reading some of your researches that you've been doing, and aside from superconductivity, I saw that you were researching heterogeneity in glasses.
Yes, that's correct.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and what it is?
Mm-hmm. So it was, in fact, research that was inspired by looking into superconductors, materials that eventually become superconducting, and that they had electronic behavior that deviated from what we usually know when we have these periodic lattice and one atom comes after the next in the exact same form and the electrons follow alike. So what we did there is we developed new techniques to understand when systems are messed up, when the electrons don't align in a perfect arrangement in the periodic shapes, for example. And that is to describe something in a precise way that is, in quotes, messed up, it turned out to be not so easy. So we developed a theoretical tool to check when the system will be amorphous or freezing. When you look at window glass, that's a very good example. The window glass is not a periodic arrangement of atoms like you have in quartz crystal. It looks like a liquid that is frozen in time and doesn't move anymore. And we looked at electrons that are frozen in time and their properties. It was, in fact, the work that I did together with a theoretical chemist, because the chemists have a lot of experience in dealing with those problems. And I learned a lot about physics and chemistry that I didn't know before.
Another one of the researches that you did was the many body effects on graphene. What exactly is that?
Okay, graphene is a conformation of carbon. So we all know when you take a piece of pencil and you draw a line, the debris of the graphite that you leave as a trace is basically the line you drew, right? So your line that you're drawing with a pencil is nothing but graphite debris, right, when you look at it with a microscope. And so we know graphite, we know diamond is another conformation of carbon, and graphene is just graphite, but taking only one single atomic layer. So it's a material that's one atomic layer thick. And then it arranges the carbon atoms in the shape of a honeycomb lattice. So just like the honeycomb that we know from eating honey. When you consider the electrons on this honeycomb lattice, it turns out that the mathematical description is very similar to the electrons of relativistic particles such as quarks that don't have a mass, or have a very small mass. So we can take this as a test bed, if you wish so, for a completely different physics that is also being discussed here at the Physics Center, namely particle physics. What we did is we developed the theory for the electric resistivity and other thermal properties and the magnetic properties of graphite, where we exploited the fact that it looks like a relativistic particle physics model, even though you can do it, well, in a little laboratory. You take a scotch tape and a pencil and realize relativistic particles in two dimensions.
And what applications would that research have?
Lots of ideas were that you could maybe build transistors and out of graphene. Probably this is not exactly the way to go, because the fact that it doesn't have a mass implies that many of the applications that we know happen in semiconductors, you can't really do that easily. One promising avenue is that when you shine light through one atomic thick layer of graphene, 97% of the light goes through and only 2.3% being absorbed. So, but on the other hand, it conducts. So imagine you have a solar panel. What you want in the solar panel, you want something that gets the electricity out, but still lets the light go through. So this is one of the very interesting applications. So you just cover this stuff with graphene, and then light could go through, and you can get rid of the electricity from where it is photoelectrically being generated. So that could be one. I'm not a person who works on applications. We are just trying to do the math. But it always makes sense to have in mind that this could well be useful to somebody. Yeah.
And you've also been working on disordered quantum phase transitions. Could right. you tell us a little bit about that?
You're just all over the place.
You guys, yes, you did your homework. Now, when you look at a novel superconductor, let's stay with those superconductors. These are very complicated materials. It's not like lead. Lead consists of lead. Those are the elements in the material. Novel superconductors with large transition temperatures, the ones that are used in the 1 kilometer wire in Essen, take yttrium, of barium, of copper, and of oxygen, or bismuth, and calcium, and so forth. So these are complex materials. It is very, very hard to get a perfect crystal out of those. We always limit it to polycrystalline, maybe impurity-affected, disorder-affected material. So we must understand, what is a piece of dirt doing to the system? And therefore, we looked into the magnetic and the superconducting properties when you make the system imperfect. That's just part of the game, because these systems are so complicated. And then you learn sometimes the dirt can even help. You can make the system a better superconductor because it's a bit dirty. But you need to understand, and you need to know what type of impurities or dirt, right, imperfections you need to bring into the system and so forth.
You're listening to Radio Physics at KDNK Community Access Radio. And with us today are Jörg Schmaljan from the Institute for Theory of Condensed Matter at the Karlsruhe Institute of Technology in Germany. Also, Ishmael Villegas from Glenwood Springs High School, and David Uhlfelder from Aspen High School. I'm Patty Fox, and we will continue now.
When you're talking about superconductivity, I'm sure there's always conflicts with the math. How do you go about trying to solve those problems?
Conflict with the math. You're constantly fighting with the math. This is part of the game, mm-hmm. obviously. First of all, it makes sense before you dig into the math. I'm a theoretical physicist. You need to do mathematics and you need to apply mathematical tricks. But it's always useful to first have a clear answer or a clear, well-defined question in mind, right? Then you try to guess the answer. It doesn't matter whether it's always right, but it's good to have a good guess. So even if the calculation is long and complex, you first try to say, well, what could be the result of my calculation? Then you need to go about a problem in several different ways. It is never that you sit down, you have a linear kind of trajectory on which you wish to solve the problem, and you just go along. You find lots of traps. Mostly they turn you into a different direction, and you answer a problem that you didn't intend to initially, but it may well end up being more interesting than the one you thought it you wanted to go after. If you have an answer, you need to find another way to confirm it. Each problem is different. Each problem has its own, tricks and beauty. But in the end, you need to go about with young people going in different directions. And I'm always working with young people. It's a fantastic job, right? So we can go about in a taxi problem in different ways. We ask, is a certain fundamental principle obeyed? Is energy conserved, right, for example, right? If you have a calculation at the end, you get a result that violates very, very fundamental principle. You know it's wrong. So you have your own tests, you have your intuition, and what you need to always do is you go to your experimental colleague who measures the stuff that you're calculating, and you double check whether this makes true sense. So there are many, many checks and balances you need to bring into your calculation. The actual mass itself is not really the barrier. The barrier is to have the right idea and to attack it in the right way.
Earlier, when we were talking about graphene, you mentioned something about transistors.
Transistors.
Yes. What are those exactly?
Well, I mean, whenever you want to control electrical signals with small voltages and small energies that you want to apply, because the battery in your cell phone is not very powerful, then you need a device that can induce large changes in currents by small applied voltages. So you need so-called non-linear, not straight-lined current voltage relationships. And this has traditionally been done through a transistor, a semiconductor device, where you have an interface between differently manipulated semiconducting structures. You just get a current and a voltage that is very, very funny shaped, so it just rises very rapidly. Now, this is how the initial transistors were built, and now, of course, I'm not an expert at all in this area, but you know that in your cell phone there are a huge number of those that are relevant for the integrated circuitry that ultimately makes computers and cell phones and so forth work. So look into semiconductors that are manipulated, have interfaces, and induces you a current voltage relationship that is not linear, and then you can build a transistor.
Jörg, you said you're often working with young people. Can you just describe your job as it has evolved? I mean, what you're doing now on a day-to-day basis, and what is the life of a theoretical physicist?
Okay, let's step back. When you start your career and you do your PhD thesis and you work on a very specific project, often you discuss this project with your advisor. You work closely together with the advisor, but as a PhD student, you are on your own. You're working hard to solve a very, very specific project such that you're pushing something to the edge and that you're the best in that problem worldwide. That's what you want to achieve. I did my PhD in Berlin at a time, and that's where I worked like this. I was working on a very narrow problem that is natural at that stage of your career because, you need to spend a lot of time to advance, and then you focus and collaborate with your advisor. Then you move on. Usually in your career, often when you stay in academia, you become what is called a postdoctoral research associate. So postdoctoral, right? That's what it is. At that point, I went to the University of Illinois and I worked closely with my advisor. Here you get a little bit more freedom, right? So you're picking a little bit more the problems that you wish to work on. You learn how it is to pick a problem, not just to solve it. But you still mostly at that time I sat in coffee places and did long calculations, right? And in the end, try to solve a problem as rigorous as you can with as relevant implications as possible. You move on, you become maybe an assistant professor, you move on in the ranks. In this position, you need to get research money. That's a big part of your career. You need to write grant proposals. You need to know what is it that I'm going to do in 3 years, because that's what the agencies want to know. You need to teach. I love teaching. It always gets you rewired and focused on the elementary aspects and parts of physics, the thermodynamics, electrodynamics, so the fundamental rules that put everything together. And you need to sit in committees, which is probably the most unpleasant part of it, right? Universities are self-administered. Professors take a lot of responsibility in whatever setting the library rules or something as exciting as this, right? So you need to do that. But the research part of your existence is that you work with people who are then doing their PhD or in their postdoctoral research phase. You sit with them, you say, this is a problem we could be doing. So you're more in identifying problems, and then you need to constantly do the calculation along with the young person, right? That's so much fun. I often don't have exactly as much time as an individual PhD student has to work on a problem, but maybe I have a bit more experience and I know a little bit how things could work. And so it's a back and forth. We meet very often, sit together for hours and do calculations together. This is the most fun part of all of it, right? Not the committee work. Teaching is fine, it's wonderful. But working there with a young woman or a young man who loves physics and sit for 3 hours and try to find a mistake in a calculation or an idea how to move forward, that's what's really fun.
How has theoretical physics changed since the beginning of your career?
First of all, there are always new topics. Right, new science topics. You constantly need to learn new tricks and new ideas because somebody came up with something that has revolutionized our thinking. Then I also need to learn it. Computers play increasingly a different role, but I'm not so much into computational physics, but they do play a big role. There are some parts of physics that work in very large collaborations. And here, maybe the dynamics is a little bit different when you work, when you try to measure the mass of the Higgs boson, right? You are working with about 1,000 other physicists together. That hasn't really changed, but the collaborations grew in size and the way they interact as well. I think biggest change probably over my career is simply that the internet, right, took over and everything is so much faster. Right, so we constantly send our results even before publication to the community. We can read them. We can see what other people's ideas are at the time. So I think mostly, like everything else in life, the internet have revolutionized it.
When you mentioned working with young students, is that referring to college or high school, or is it both?
Oh, when I mean young, I mean students who are a bit older than you guys. So for you, they are very old. So in the German system, when you are basically in your third year of university study, you do a bachelor thesis. So you work with a professor for about a month. That's when it starts. You write your first thesis project. You need to present it in a talk. Usually it's not original research, but you summarize something that other people had done. Then you do your master's thesis. It's an actual thesis that goes over about a year. So then at that stage, people are in their mid-20s, early mid-20s. And eventually, when you then decide to go for a PhD career, then you work even more closely with your advisor or professor and so forth. So those are the young people I had in mind, right? Mm-hmm. So old geezers from your perspective, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When you work with these young people, what were some of the topics that you researched?
I mean, that's what I'm doing, right? That's what I'm good at. That's what I'm doing with PhD students. And when you have a work there that's concerned, say, with glassiness in electronic systems, there, of course, is very often on the paper that we publish a PhD student. So clearly, it's not my work, it's our work, right? The same with our work on superconductivity most recently. That's with the group I've now built during the last 5 years in Karlsruhe. It's with them, it's together, right? So they are as much responsible for the results that I am.
We've come to the end of Radio Physics, and I'd like to thank very much Jörg Schmaljan and Ishmael Villegas, David Ulfelder, for joining us today. You can listen to Radio Physics the fourth Tuesday of every month, 4:30, here at KDNK Community Access Radio. I'm Patty Fox, and I hope you'll tune in next month.